Welcome to Catholics Across the Aisle, the podcast of the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops, offering commentary on public policy and civic life. This is Michael Sheedy, Executive Director of the conference. I'm Michael Sheedy, again with Terry Coonan, head of the Florida State University Center for the Advancement of Human Rights. Terry, it's great to be with you again.
Michael, great to join you again here.
Terry, one of the topics we like to focus on a bit more is immigration. I know that prior to coming to lead the center here at Florida State University, you had a lot of good experience in immigration law. And you've got a good view for just how things have changed, how people see the issue, how things can perhaps be improved. And you've also kind of followed the approach that the bishops have taken in trying to advocate for better immigration reform. Maybe you could just start by talking about your experience as an immigration attorney. What drew you to that and what your work was like?
Absolutely. Yeah, Michael, much of my legal background, I have obviously worked in the human rights field, but much of that has been in the context of immigration law. And that has been a very important sort of human rights experience for me. My original sort of human rights work, advocacy work, was in Latin America. It was in the mid-1980s and the 1990s dealing with military dictatorships in Chile, doing sort of hands-on human rights work there. At the time, I was actually considering priesthood, was studying in the Catholic seminary that brought me to Latin America. I was with our great Holy Cross priests up in Notre Dame, Indiana, that you and I know well. But it was very interesting for me that ultimately, and in large part because of that experience of hands-on advocacy in Latin America, that it gave me a sense that there's this whole large group of people, immigrants, refugees, in many ways, torture survivors, asylum seekers. It was those issues that I saw on the ground, literally in a military dictatorship, but that also then led me finally to the study of the law, but not just the law, but the question of how can the rule of law, or in my case, U.S. law, how can that be better put in the service of people who are voiceless? And that for me was the reason to go through law school, ultimately. It was this idea that we have this wide range of quite needy people, and that immigration law is very complex and at times very hostile, to be quite honest. And how could they be better represented, especially those that had suffered egregious human rights violations, such as what I saw in Latin America? So that when I ultimately did come back and go through law school here in the United States, a real focus, a recognition on my part was that a great deal of the human rights field in the United States involves our immigrants, refugees, people who are fleeing persecution in particular. It's what we call fear-based immigration in the immigration law field. And that was really what drew me into that field. Some of my initial work was with the UN High Commission for Refugees, both in Geneva, but then also here in the United States. My first job after law school was through the U.S. Justice Department, they call their honors program, but it involved working in South Texas in immigration courts, where I literally got to see, here's where the rubber meets the road. Here's where an immigrant who comes in to the United States fearful for their lives, here's what they have to prove up. Here are the different immigration remedies that are available to them. And to be quite honest, very difficult to get those. Less than a 20% success rate when people apply for asylum, even less if a person is not represented by an attorney. It's a very complex area of law, very daunting. I don't know how someone could navigate that without legal assistance. And that was really what I wanted to do. After I worked with the Justice Department for several years, and some of it was advising U.S. immigration judges. I was based in San Antonio, but a lot of my work was all over the border area of South Texas, which gave me quite a hands-on sense of here's where the rubber meets the road. Here's what it's like for a family to flee from Honduras or Guatemala, or a child. Here's what a minor, a 14-year-old male who flees gangs in Honduras, here's what their lived experience is like. What I've seen over the years, too, is that a great many more of the cases, and we litigate these cases through our Human Rights Center at FSU. We do pro bono immigration work for human rights victims, but a great many of those victims are fleeing gender-based human rights violations, especially young women. That has greatly increased our caseload in, say, the last 10 or 15 years. But what we're starting to see, and again, I think all of us maybe needed a constant reminder that, man, we live in one of the best countries in the world. And in a sense, the fact that people flee to this country is a testimony to just how America continues to be viewed. It really is a beacon of freedom. And people continue to see us as one of the great countries of the world. It's why they still flock to our borders. As an immigration lawyer, I understand that not everyone can come. That, again, especially when it comes to human rights remedies, if you're going to seek asylum here, you have to be able to prove that you've got a well-founded fear of persecution. Someone wants to hurt you or persecute you based on your race, your religion, your nationality, your political opinion, maybe a particular social group that you belong to. It's not enough to just want a better job, sadly. So that our immigration laws have always been quite clear that if you're just seeking a better job, just economic opportunities, the realm of human rights remedies, such as asylum, it's really not open to you. Now, when I work with employers, and this is what I've learned in sort of doing business immigration laws, that there's a great many jobs U.S. citizens choose not to do, and that it is our foreign national population that will oftentimes be the ones that want to fill those jobs. What's interesting to me is that we clearly need comprehensive immigration reform. It's become very politicized, this idea we have to lock down our border before we can do that. Well, that's perhaps not truly realistic. I don't know that we'll ever be able to completely lock down a border, nor should we. The idea that we could build a wall is, for me, actually almost nonsense. That actually technology provides us with much better means of controlling our borders than building a physical wall. But what we have to do is find that, not, I don't want to call it a compromise, but just that balance between making sure that we are still a haven for people that have suffered egregious human rights violations or fear those things. The work that I've done as a refugee and asylum lawyer very much geared up towards that group of victims. And that is the best of America. I mean, that's what makes me proud to be an American, that literally, you know, the Statue of Liberty means something. It's also an understanding that those immigrants don't really threaten our jobs, that our immigrants are filling in many of the gaps in our economy. That was especially evident during the pandemic. It's no accident that many of what we called essential workers were immigrants. They were working in our food supply chain, in our healthcare system. They were doing a host of things that, again, not the best paying jobs, but turned out to be absolutely critical to our country. It gave me a renewed appreciation of what our immigrants here in the United States do. I'm especially taken and a strong proponent of, again, what our Catholic bishops have said, that we need to have a humane immigration policy, that yes, we need border security. And no one, I think, in their right mind would argue against that. But we also have to have a policy that's essentially humane and that actually looks at holistically who are the people at our borders. And even if they can't be admitted to our borders, can we have humane procedures for processing them or times for, again, returning them to their home countries? There's a balance and a really important one that I think our Catholic social teachings and the policy work that our National Conference of Catholic Bishops continues to do in that area.
Now, Terry, you spoke a bit about refugees. You spoke about people seeking asylum. There may be listeners who are not as clear as to the different groupings of different types of immigrants who are seeking some kind of status here. You've got people who are needing temporary protective status because they're from a country that has, you know, undergone some major social tumult. Maybe just paint the picture of the different categories.
Absolutely, Mike. That could be very helpful. It's in a sense what I teach in my immigration law classes at the law school. Here are the different remedies that in particular are human rights based. So the first one that you mentioned, and it's really foundational to who we are as a country, It's essentially giving safe haven to refugees. And there's a whole international law definition. We actually have incorporated that into our U.S. law. But it essentially says if you're about to face persecution, and that could be because of your race, it could be because of your religion, could be because of your nationality, it could be a political opinion. For years we have offered especially political asylum to people fleeing oppressive regimes, many of them communists, but many of them in more recent years, not communists, but just quite brutal regimes. Or it could be a particular social group. It could be your tribe. If you were a member of the Tutsi tribes or the Tutsi ethnic group in Rwanda in the mid-1990s, you were the object of the genocide. So that some of the initial asylum cases that I worked were Tutsis that had fled Rwanda, literally fleeing genocide. So this is one of the best parts of our American law, but it's fear-based. And you have to show that you would truly face a credible fear of persecution. And the scrutiny is quite severe. When I walk an asylum seeker into court, they have already prepared a statement that's been submitted to the immigration judge and to the government attorney about here's why I am afraid to come back to my home country. And they will be grilled on that. They'll be grilled for consistency. When they give their oral testimony, is it the same? Is it consistent with the written statement that they put in? And they will also be grilled about, well, are you really just coming here to try to get a better job? Because that is not a grounds for asylum. And a great many of our asylum seekers are, in fact, returned to their home countries. We call it removal or deportation. If, in fact, they cannot articulate that they have this well-founded fear of persecution. Now, that is a long, I think, honored tradition here in the United States. Our history has been built on asylum. Again, even before we called it asylum, we were a refuge, and we continue to be so. Asylum is one of the prime things, and that it's one of the things that we do in our Human Rights Center. On the other hand, too, if you have committed a crime, if you have been yourself a persecutor, you cannot qualify for asylum. So there is a quite significant scrutiny that the U.S. government will engage in before someone is allowed asylum. That's for a person who's already here. We also have a refugee population. These are also people who have actually experienced a fear of persecution, but they were recognized as having that fear outside the country so that they were either processed through the United Nations or through a U.S. embassy where it's already been, in a sense, vetted. So, for instance, here in Tallahassee, we have a significant refugee population from the Democratic Republic of Congo. A great deal of our work at our Human Rights Center is with families, many of them Catholic, although that's not why they were persecuted, but they were in war zones. Sadly, the DRC has also been referred to as the rape capital of the world. A great many of the women that from these families have all suffered, many of them repeated sexual violations. So this is the best of our system. It's saying that we will allow you to come into the United States. You're recognized as a refugee outside the country. You come in, you have refugee status for 1 year. You're then allowed to apply for what's called permanent residence. We used to call it a green card. And then after 5 years of that, you're allowed to apply for citizenship. I have to tell you, and again, it makes me proud to be an American. This is one of the most generous sort of processes in the world. Other countries, as part of how they honor their international law obligations, they may say, well, we'll put refugees in camps, but we won't let them actually become part of our country. So we've had camps in Thailand or in Hong Kong, Vietnamese, say in Hong Kong, who've been there for 40 or 50 years, never able to actually become a citizen of the country that they're actually in. But technically the host country, by not deporting them back to their place where their lives would be at risk, they're still honoring their international law obligations. Other countries treat refugees like commodities. They trade them. They say, you know, we'll trade you X number of refugees for a better deal on car imports. It's not illegal. It's quite inhumane in many ways, but it basically still honors the obligation to not send the refugee back to the home country where they would fear. Some countries, too, and Mexico was a classic example, when there were issues in Guatemala, genocide in Guatemala, Mexico allowed many of the asylum seekers to remain in Mexico, but only until the genocide subsided. And they then sent them back to Guatemala. It was called repatriation. It was controversial. It wasn't clear how safe it was, but they had honored their international law obligation by not sending them back at the time when they would have been subjected to that genocide. The United States is actually a model country in many ways, that we have this process to not only protect them, but to allow them ultimately to even be on the track for citizenship. TPS that you mentioned is a little different. It's called temporary protected status. That can be offered not just for things like political persecution, but natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes. And again, it is a quite generous part of U.S. law that says we'll allow people who were already here in the country when that calamity happened in their country, they can actually be given temporary protected status. It's looked at and renewed or not renewed annually by Congress. And it's this idea that we don't send people back to devastated countries. So again, strong human rights background. It's not a durable solution, meaning it doesn't lead to permanent residence or to citizenship, but it's meant to keep people out of the eyes of the storm. More recently, we also have the same kinds of protection durable for torture survivors. Our Convention Against Torture, international law that we've signed, allows someone to ask an immigration judge, "Judge, either I have been tortured or I would face it. Please don't send me back." And for trafficking victims, too, a special T visa. It's called a trafficking visa. It's one of the things that we apply for on behalf of the trafficking victims that we work with. And that gives them essentially a 5-year visa, allows them to legally live and work in the United States. It does allow them to apply for permanent residence at the end of those 5 years. So a strong human rights component to that, this idea that those are victims that what they suffered was here in the United States. It wasn't in a home country. And we give them the same benefits that we give to refugees. So we give them work authorization, job training, English language training. Much of the work that we do in our Human Rights Center is working with both refugees and with our trafficking victims, who are very generously by the United States given the same kinds of benefits.
As we look at the landscape here in the United States again, we also, it may be worth saying a bit about DACA recipients and Dreamers.
Another great group that I think has rightfully claimed our attention. Our Dream Act students. Again, these were all students now, you know, many of them in their 20s and their 30s, but that were brought in by typically parents who either came in undocumented or maybe came in legally but didn't leave when their visa expired. And as it turns out, the child didn't actually choose to come here illegally, to remain illegally. Many of the students that we've worked with at Florida State University, who are Dreamers, told me that I didn't even know I was undocumented until it was time for me to get my driver's license. And suddenly my parents then had to tell me, "Oh, you don't actually have the papers that can show that you were born here in the United States. You're actually not eligible for a driver's license." And for a number of them, that was the heartbreaking moment when they realized that even though they had been raised here, they had been Boy Scouts or played sports, they had potentially, you know, worked here, but that suddenly they realized, "Oh, I'm actually not legal," and devastating for so many of them. And what we realized as a country is that they were ours, that we have educated them. They are some of the most promising young people that we have. We desperately need what they can bring to us. They're some of our most accomplished young students. They serve in our military. Many of them were first responders in recent hurricanes and during the pandemic. So again, a very human rights oriented sort of legal initiative that says that if you were brought here at a young age, if you don't have a criminal record, if you can show that you were in school here, we will grant you. And even now, it's not durable. So that, again, there's still a political battle going on. Will we allow them to permanently remain? But what we have done is protect them from removal, from deportation. And the current administration has attempted to fortify their sort of their legal situation, as it were.
Well, it does seem that, you know, looking at this group through a political lens, you know, we do try to make sure that it's fair to say that immigration policy is really a federal matter. It's not so much a state matter. The states getting involved in immigration law tend to create more of a patchwork system that doesn't typically hold up in the courts very well.
Yeah, that's been a dilemma that we've seen play out recently here in Florida and a number of other states as well. But that immigration is a federal law function, and that it remains preeminently a federal law function. The immigration courts, one of which I worked in for a number of years, that's federal law, and it's the same law across the boards. There's at times confusion about that. There have been some programs that I don't think were wise that, in a sense, basically deputized state law enforcement or local law enforcement to be immigration agents. And the unforeseen sort of problem that came with that is that once immigrant communities, whether here in Florida or around the country, once they perceived that the local police officer who might respond to a call for crime in their neighborhood, once he's perceived as a potential immigration agent, people stopped calling in crimes. And it had led to crime spikes all over the country. And what was quite interesting is that a great many state and local law enforcement ultimately said, no, we actually do not want to be mandated or, in a sense, deputized to be immigration officials. That's a federal function, and it's what the federal government, what the Department of Homeland Security, what they're trained to do. But that local law enforcement understood quite clearly after some bad experiences is that we have a protective function, and our communities will become crime ridden if, in particular, immigrant neighborhoods are afraid to call in to report crimes. So that's been sort of the practical learned lesson. And by a great many of our law enforcement officers who said, this may just not have been the wisest approach for us to take. Now, do we have an immigration issue? Of course we do. Yeah, and that continues to be something that in particular needs to be addressed. One of the issues that many of us in the advocacy community feel quite strongly about is, again, the situation of what we call unaccompanied alien minors. And we have seen this spike that, again, all you have to do is turn on any news channel, whether it's one on the left or the right, to understand, yeah, there's a huge crisis at our border. And what has changed at the border over the years, Michael, when I was working at the border in the 1990s, the undocumented immigrant tended to be a young male, maybe early 20s. They were coming here to work. They were coming here because many of them knew there were jobs waiting for them that Americans didn't want to do. What has changed significantly is that it's children. In the last couple of years, it is children that have actually been brought here, fleeing things like sexual violence, young women, but also males fleeing gang violence or simply the kinds of persecution or repression that they're experiencing in countries. Right now in Honduras, MS-13 is better armed than Honduran law enforcement is. There's 40,000 MS-13 gang members, many of which we deported to Honduras, and then it has led to essentially a lawless country where young people are at great risk. Those are the type of people that are fleeing to the United States now. And again, we privilege childhood. We understand that U.S. law has a particular concern for children, and it's this question of how can we legally assist them, again, provide them with an asylum hearing, or reunite them with a sponsor. That's some of the work that we do as well at our center when children are brought here to the United States who do not have a caregiver. They're not with a family member or anyone that can protect them. Can't we do a better job? And again, that's an ongoing issue. One situation, President Obama sought to, in a sense, incarcerate both families and their children. Basically say, you have to wait for an immigration proceeding. And if you're a child, well, we're going to detain you, but we'll detain you with your family. There was a 1997 legal agreement. It's called the Flores Agreement. And it was a quite unusual animal. It was a settlement at the Supreme Court level that basically the Supreme Court said it will be international or national policy that children should not be held longer than 20 days. You cannot detain them longer than 20 days. And again, President Obama was sort of spanked by the federal courts when he said, well, I'm going to detain them longer than 20 days as long as they're with their families. And the court said, no, children cannot be detained longer than 20 days. the Republican administration of President Trump that followed, a quite disturbing policy of family separations, taking children away from their parents, both morally and legally a disaster. The American Medical Association said this is nothing more than legalized child abuse. And it was short-lived. It was so disastrous. There's still several hundred children that we don't know where their parents are, that it's on our watch here in the United States. They're children taken from their parents. Parents were deported. And now we don't know where those parents are or how those children could be reunited. So, again, a strong reminder that we have to have immigration policies that are both humane and long-sighted. Right now, the Biden administration is dealing with this complication that there's been a perception that with the change in administration, U.S. immigration laws have changed significantly. Well, they haven't. And this is the problem. So there's been this influx of children. The attempt is to, of course, reunite them with sponsors or with family members here in the United States, and then to allow them to go forward and seek remedies under the care of those family members. We have a great new facility actually over in Madison County, just opened a couple months ago, an interim facility where kids can get taken out of the sort of tent cities that they're in the border. I've actually monitored and been there a couple times to look at, you know, what are the facilities like at the border in El Paso or in other communities. But the idea is get them out of those tent cities and reunite them with families or sponsors so that their case can then be looked at without that sort of huge influx at the border. So that's an area where, you know, we continue to, I think, to want to exercise special care. Again, our Catholic Church has been very, very strong on how we have to protect children. That's part of who we are as a church community, but as a nation as well. And the testimony and really the witness of our national Conference of Catholic Bishops has been so important in that policy realm.
You know, as I look back on the history of the church in Florida and our involvement in various activities, including immigration, I'm often reminded of the Pedro Pod program that brought children into the United States from Cuba in the midst of the revolution there, a generation of Cuban Americans now who really have had prominent roles in our society, including one of our bishops, mm-hmm. the U.S. Senator.
Mel Martinez, absolutely. Yeah, a tremendous program that took children out of the teeth of a military dictatorship, a communist dictatorship, and gave them a whole new lease on life. Absolutely. And it was, again, it was the best of America's instincts in terms of this is the protective function that we need to be about. And we do understand, you know, that there are at times influxes of immigrants. You know, the recent case of Haitians who of all places, you know, gathered in Del Rio, Florida. Where did they come from? They came not just from Haiti, but from all over Latin America. And again, many of them sent back. They were given what's called a credible fear hearing. And this is, again, it's a short 15-minute hearing when someone arrives in the United States without documentation or without a visa, maybe they're completely undocumented, they're given a credible fear hearing. It's short, about 15 minutes, but in a sense, they have to be able to articulate a credible fear of persecution. And if not, and in particular, if they're upfront about the fact that they're only coming here for a job or for better economic opportunities, they might be desperately poor, and that's heartbreaking. But once again, our laws don't allow them to come into the United States. So that's where a great many of the Haitians were returned to Haiti. A great many others who did have family members or churches that might sponsor them have been released to those sponsors with the whole idea that that sponsor is financially responsible for that immigrant while they go through their immigration proceedings. Now, in one sense, a great many of them will not have an immigration remedy, that, you know, they may end up having to go back to Haiti. And for those that may not have been there for many years, and Haiti has just had, you know, their president assassinated, they've just had yet another earthquake. So, you know, Haiti is a devastated place right now. But sadly, our refugee and asylum laws won't cover the situation for everyone, but it doesn't mean that we don't provide humane treatment for them or a humane process. And that is a challenge. We understand that. And that as Americans, we're practical. We respond to challenges.
I will just share one other anecdotal point. I think particularly in Florida, with our number of military bases, a significant military presence here, there's a recognition for those people who have helped us abroad, helped our military abroad. When you consider the situation in Afghanistan, you look to Iraq, places like that where the involvement of our military has been really significant, and nationals there have helped our country. It's been important that we honor our commitments and to protect them, because as political situations change and people become at risk again, you mentioned.
That's been, I think, one of the toughest current challenges. We've been contacted at our Human Rights Center by family members who have family back, especially in Afghanistan, who worked as translators or as support people for our military mission there. They weren't able to get out, so that they're having to live in hiding. And we are in the process of getting these desperate calls from the family members here in the United States. Can you help us get this person out? They have a target on their back. I mean, they would be the classic asylum seeker. They would have a well-founded fear of persecution. Of course, the Taliban will be targeting them. I mean, it's striking that one of the first things the Taliban did, closed universities to women. That, again, this kind of throwback, just sort of misogynistic and quite inhumane regime that has just been sort of given legal sanction there, is quite horrifying. And again, a lot of second guessing. Couldn't we have done this better? How many people did we leave behind that we should have gotten out of harm's way? Again, one of the tragedies of how quickly that situation was just overcome by events. So, yeah, I know that, again, a great many families, churches, communities are welcoming Afghan refugees. We actually have just heard that we may have some of them here in Tallahassee. We work very closely at our Human Rights Center with a great group, the International Rescue Group, the IRC, International Rescue Committee. They do a lot of the hands-on work in terms of actually caring for the refugees, whether they're from Syria or Iraq, whether they're from Afghanistan or the Congo. We've had recent cases from Colombia and El Salvador. But again, it's part of that great promise of America that there are these great people and organizations that are stepping up, and we hope we can do more, again, for the desperate people that have been left behind in Afghanistan. But a tough call, really tough.
Well, Terry, I have to say thank you for what you've shared here, giving us a lot more insight into immigration generally and very specifically from a legal framework and what's happening today, helping us to get a good footing and understanding all of that.
Glad to do it. We're an immigrant country. We will continue to be. And it's what makes America great. So thank you for having me.